brilliant. I'm just going to spend a couple of minutes making you aware of this book. Jamie's already said that one of the best things you can do in order to investigate Christianity is to pick up a gospel and read it. And so we've actually offered you these John's Gospels. If you know, Gospels are biographies of Jesus in the Bible. There are four of them, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And this is the fourth one, John, written by a great friend of Jesus's. And I just want to draw your attention to a few sentences from this book, because I think actually they help us to make sense not only of science, but also of how life works. And maybe it'll make sense of your life as well. Let me start with the story of Rachel the botanist. Okay, imagine Rachel the botanist, and she is in the lab on a Monday morning when Gary, the lab assistant, comes in from a weekend away, and Rachel just says to Gary, "Thank you so much for that botanical specimen that you gave me last week. I've just been doing nothing but exploring and investigating this wonderful specimen." Gary doesn't know what she's talking about, but Rachel just continues, and she says, "You know, I've mapped its genome over the weekend. Incredible. It's a first for this particular species. I've discovered an entire ecosystem living on one of the leaves. Again, another first." She says, "I've also discovered these pharmacological properties of the specimen that are going to help us in the fight against Alzheimer's disease. I'm just thrilled. Thank you so much for giving me this botanical specimen." Gary says, "Rachel, it was not a botanical specimen. It was February the 14th. It was a long stem rose. Do you understand what I gave to you?" And that's the question, isn't it? Did Rachel understand the rose? And on one level, she understood the rose really, really well. She understood that rose better than anyone has ever understood roses before in the history of humankind. Maybe she'll get a Nobel Prize. Wow. On the other hand, does Rachel understand the rose? No. She is a moron. At the romantic level, she is a moron. At the scientific level, she is a genius. But to think that she understands everything it is possible to understand about roses simply by doing scientific investigation is, of course, ridiculous. But here's the question. What if the world is like that rose? What if the whole world is a love gift, and it's from somebody telling you that they love you? In which case, maybe there's more than one way to investigate this world. Maybe one way is to go into the laboratory and to map genomes and to look down telescopes and look up through telescopes and look down through microscopes and do the tests. Maybe that's one way of understanding the world, and it's a great way of understanding the world. But maybe there's more than one way of understanding the world. Maybe this world is a communication from somebody else trying to tell us that they love us. In which case, understanding the world at that level is not going to happen scientifically. It won't do. It can't do. There is a level of meaning to this world, and it does not exist at the levels of, you know, pixie dust and fairies and magic. But there is a level of meaning to this world that is as a communication from someone telling us that they love us. And Christians are just saying, let's do both. Let's go into the laboratory and let's understand the world scientifically, but let's also understand whether this world might have a maker and there might be a message, there might be a meaning. You see, but if we spend all our time dealing with mechanisms, we'll never get to the maker and the message and the meaning. We'll just be like Rachel, mapping the genome of a Valentine's gift. And what we want to encourage everyone to do is to run into the laboratory and do all the science that we can, but not to think that we have exhaustively understood the world thereby. Actually, the way we understand the world is by understanding its maker, who has a message for us and a meaning to live out in this world. Let's have a look at page one of these John's Gospels. I want to introduce you to where I think science has come from. Because have you ever wondered about the absolute miracle that makes science possible? The miracle that makes science possible is this. you need to have, in order for science to work, you need to have laws up above that are regular, that are comprehensible, that are rationally ordered and able to be rationally understood. You need laws up above. You need minds in here that are trustworthy and that can understand the laws up above. And you need a world out there that is not an illusion, a world out there that can be trusted and sensed and investigated. So you need all three of those things. You need laws up above, you need minds in here, and you need a world out there. And you need those three things to triangulate. And actually, plenty of people have looked out at the world and they've said, isn't it incredible that science works? Isn't it amazing that the world out there seems to operate according to laws up above that I can understand with this 2.5 pounds of gray matter? Isn't that astonishing that that should be the case? Why should that be the case? Albert Einstein said the great miracle of existence is that the universe is comprehensible. It's a miracle. It cannot be understood scientifically. It is the miracle on which science is founded. Why should it be the case? Well, John chapter 1 might give us some clues. Here's the beginning of this biography of Jesus. It says, in the beginning, so page 1 under the heading, the Word became flesh. In the beginning was the Word. Word is, in the Greek, it's the word logos, from which we get the word logic. In the beginning, there was a logic, there was a rationality, there was a harmony. In the beginning was this person called the Word, who is logic himself. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. So this says that before and behind this universe, there is a God of harmony, a God of order, a God of rationality, who has, through rationality, created a harmonious universe. The universe is not a chaos. It is a cosmos. It is a rationally ordered, rationally comprehensible universe, a universe you can understand. Now, why can you understand it? Why can Homo sapiens understand the universe? Why in this little corner of the Milky Way are there these creatures that have this ability to understand the mystery of the cosmos? Why should that be? Well, verse 14 might give us a clue. Little number 14, reverse to verse 14, two-thirds of the way down the page. The Word, the one who was there in the beginning, became flesh, a human being, and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. It's referring to Jesus. Jesus is this rationality behind the whole universe. And he took flesh. He became human and dwelt among us. And John, one of Jesus' best friends, writes, we've clapped eyes on him. And we have seen the rationality of the cosmos made flesh. We've seen the operating system of the universe walking around on two legs. It's amazing. And according to the Bible, actually, you and I, human beings, we are made for a relationship with this person called the Word. And therefore, it shouldn't be surprising to us that these minds are able to grasp the rationality of the cosmos. It shouldn't be surprising to us. We've been made in order to know the very logic of reality. And so for the Christian, it is not inexplicable at all to know that there are laws up above, minds in here, and a world out there that triangulate. It's exactly what you would expect if this book is true. Now, if this book is not true, if we are nothing but matter in motion, if there has been no rationality behind this universe, no rationality behind our creation, why on earth should science work? There's no reason to expect it to work unless you've got this rationality behind the cosmos. So actually, Christians believe that science has grown up out of this kind of understanding of the world. And historically, that is just the case. Modern science, the way we do it today, has emerged in Christian cultures in which people have had this kind of view of the world. C.S. Lewis said that people became scientific because they expected laws in nature. They expected laws in nature because they believed in a lawgiver. So actually, Christianity gives the strongest possible foundation for doing science. And far from scientific advances kind of shrinking space for God in the world, Actually, when you see things this way, you realize that every single scientific advance only confirms the Bible's story. It only goes to show that, yes, we have every good reason to believe that laws up above, minds in here, and the world out there coheres. Because there is a Word who was there in the beginning, and he became flesh. So there is every good reason for a Christian to do science. But I wonder about you. I wonder what it would take for you to believe this story. What would it take you to believe in God? What would be the evidence that would lead you to faith? Let's turn to the very end of John's Gospel. We'll do the very beginning and the very end to give you an idea of this book. And then I just pray that you will take this book away and read it for yourself. These are our gifts to you, by the way. Absolutely our gifts. If you've got a Bible at home, try not to get any orange juice on it and leave it here for tomorrow. But if you haven't read the Bible in the last 6 months, this is our gift to you. We'd love you to take it. But I want to take you to page 51 and this famous incident of someone who goes from doubt to belief. There is evidence that confronts somebody. And it turns them from a doubter to a believer. It's the case of Doubting Thomas. Have you heard of Doubting Thomas? That poor guy, Doubting Thomas. He doubts for like 7 days. And for 2,000 years, we just keep on calling him Doubting Thomas. He was an incredible disciple of Jesus. He went and preached the gospel in India and, you know, took the gospel to the nations and died for his faith. But all we remember is 1 week of doubt. Poor Thomas. Okay. But here's how Doubting Thomas comes to believe, okay? Here's the evidence that converts him to faith in Jesus. So two-thirds of the way down the page, Jesus appears to Thomas, verse 24. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. It's talking about Easter Sunday. So a week earlier, Jesus has risen from the dead and he's appeared to everybody alive again after death. Thomas wasn't there. So the other disciples told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." Right, so this is his standard of proof, okay? This is the evidence that he demands in order to go from doubt to belief. What do you make of this standard of proof? Perhaps you think Thomas is a little bit sick. Do you think Thomas is a little bit sick? If I go into hospital and you come around to the ward and I say, "No, I'm ill, I promise you I'm ill," and you say, "Unless I put my hand into your wounds, I will not believe," you have no visiting rights. I don't want to see you. Leave the grapes and just go. You're sick. What is Thomas doing here? Thomas is wanting to see not just that Jesus appears back from the dead, but he wants to know that it's the same Jesus who went through the cross and came out the other side. It's the same Jesus who suffered and bled and died for him. That same Jesus has passed through death and conquered death for all time. He wants to know that. Not just have this heavenly apparition. He wants to know that Jesus has pioneered a way through death and come out the other side. That's his standard of proof. "I want to see these scars," says Thomas. Well, verse 26, a week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Then he said to Thomas, "Put your finger here, see my hands. Reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." Over the page. Then Jesus told him, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So what standard of proof would you demand in order for God to show himself? I once asked an atheist friend that. I said, "What would make you believe in God?" And my atheist friend said, "If God rearranged the stars in the sky in order to spell out the Ten Commandments, then I would know there was a God, then I would believe." I wonder where you set the bar for proof for God. My friend set it to galactic heights. And as he did so, I kind of had two thoughts simultaneously as he said that, which is very unusual for me. I average about two thoughts a month, but this I was on my fifth coffee and just buzzing. I had these two thoughts. The first thought I had was a line from Immanuel Kant. He was the old Prussian philosopher from the 18th century. And he said, you know, if the stars only came out once every 1,000 years, we'd think it was the most incredible miracle known to man. The fact they come out every single night makes us more disdainful than actually believing. And it got me thinking that, you know, actually, the finely tuned order of this cosmos is already an incredible miracle. The facts that the stars are in their current arrangement and that the current arrangement of the entire cosmos allows me to exist and see the stars, that is already a miracle of biblical proportions. Perhaps in a second I can show you one or two facts that will go to prove the fact that the current arrangement of the heavens is already miraculous. You don't have to wonder what it would be like to witness a miracle. You're living in one. You absolutely are living in a miracle right now. That was the first thought I had to say to him, that the stars are already miraculous. And actually, if the stars happen to rearrange to spell out some Hebrew letters, that would be a cheap parlor trick, just piggybacking on the back of a gargantuan wonder. The universe in its current arrangement is already an incredible miracle. But that's not what I said to him. He said, I want to see the stars rearranging and spelling out the Ten Commandments. The thought that I voiced was, would you like such a God? If God is rearranging constellations just to get you to behave, would you like such a God? He said, oh no, I could never like God. But if he proved to me his existence, then I would have to submit to him. I would have to believe. I could never like God, though. And at that point, I had great agreement with my friend, because actually the God he did not believe in, I didn't like very much either. See, the kind of God he thought might be up there is a God who basically wants his people to bow. Just basically a distant individual, high on power, low on personality, just trying to crush down on his subjects. And I don't believe in that. What is it that actually convinces Thomas? It's interesting. What convinces Thomas is not so much stars as scars. Isn't that interesting? It's scars that win the heart of Thomas. Why is that? Well, I guess these scars are telling a scar story. You know about scar stories, don't you? If I'm ever teaching youth, I'll ask the kids, you know, does anyone here have a scar story? And about 15 boys' hands shoot up and no girls' hands shoot up. And all the boys want to lift up their t-shirt and show you, you know, these horrible pink scaly things. And they've got a scar story that attaches to these scars. And the scar story always goes a little bit like this. I was running along just happily until I encountered whatever it was, the black run on the ski slopes, or the power of gravity, or the cricket ball, or the kitchen window, or whatever it was. And then you tell a little bit about how much it hurt, and you tell all sorts of gross, you know, stories about the pus that oozed out and every other kind of liquid that was excreted from whatever kind of scar you had. And then you say, but it's okay now, and I've got the scar to prove the story. That's how every scar story runs. And isn't it amazing to think God has a scar story? This is what will win your heart, okay? God has a scar story. Everything was going really swimmingly for God until he encountered planet Earth. And that was brutal. Because when the God of heaven showed up on planet Earth, we did not want him. When the word of the cosmos, when the very rationality of all things showed up on planet Earth, he was just love covered over in flesh. That's who Jesus was. And yet, we did not want him. We wanted to silence the word of God. We wanted to shut him up. And actually, what they did historically, we all do humanly every day. I was talking to a student back in February, and I said to her, you know, I really want you to read this John's Gospel. It's amazing, because what if God showed up on planet Earth and you could get to know him? She said, that would be really inconvenient. I said, why do you say inconvenient? She said, well, I just want to live life the way I want to live life. If God shows up, he might have some ideas. No, it would be really inconvenient if God showed up. I think she was just being honest, actually. That's the cry of the human heart. See, the cry of the human heart is, no one's got the right to tell me what to do, right? I mean, if I ask you the question right now, just answer silently in your heart, who's got the right to tell you what to do? What does your heart do? If your heart is anything like mine, it says, no one's got the right to tell me what to do. Well, of course, the God who made you does. And yet when the God who made us showed up on planet Earth, we wanted to silence the word of God. We wanted to shut up Jesus. We wanted to kill him. And we did that. And that's where he got his scars. But he was very glad to take those scars on, because this is why he came. He came to a planet that was running away from him. And he said, you know what? When you run away from the light, you end up in the darkness. When you run away from the one who is life, you end up in death. So what does Jesus do? He says, let me take your darkness on myself. Let me take your death on myself. And this is what Jesus does. Good Friday, we've just had it. We've just had this celebration of Jesus taking the darkness of your rebellion and my rebellion onto himself. Taking the death that you and I deserve for running away from God. That's how he got his scars. He went to hell and back for you and me. He's this battle-scarred warrior who has taken on our biggest enemies, death, hell. And he's got the scars to prove the story. Yet wonderfully, even as Jesus' friends had sold him out and left him for dead that weekend, he rises up again from the dead and he tracks down his worthless friends from beyond the grave. You think, well, what's he going to do? They've just left him for dead and he tracks them down from beyond the grave. What does he do? He says, peace, peace. He says, I want that friendship with you. I've tracked you down so that I can bring you home into my light, into my life, into my love. And so what does Thomas see? He sees these scars that tell a scar story, that tell of a battle-scarred warrior who's gone to hell and back for him, and it wins his heart. And what does he say? He says, my Lord and my God. That's what wins his heart. What would win your heart? What would be the evidence that would convince you that Jesus rose from the dead? Let me give you a few reasons why you should believe that Jesus did in fact conquer death. A few historical facts to sink your teeth into, because faith is not the absence of evidence, faith is based on evidence. So here's some evidence to wrap your head around. I'll give it under the heading of three H's. Okay, the first bit of evidence, the heavens. The heavens are already telling you that there is a life from the dead God. You see, the arrangement of the stars, as I've said, the arrangement of this cosmos is already an incredible miracle. Go home and Google fine-tuning of the cosmos, and you'll see that there are these physical constants that have to be just so in order for there to be a life-permitting universe, in order for there to be a cosmos and not a chaos, in order for there to be this 2.5 pounds of gray matter that can understand the world. Things have to be just so. Things like the cosmological constant that describes the rate of expansion in the universe. If it's too fast, then the universe flings out into heat death. If it's too slow, the universe just crunches back on itself. It has to be just right. And you have to ask the question, what is this Goldilocks range in which the cosmological constant has to be in order for there to be a life-permitting cosmos? You know what it's got to be? It's got to be 1 in 10 to the power 120. If it's 1 in 10 to the power 122 quick, we freeze. If it's 1 in 10 to the power 122 slow, we crunch. But it's just right. And to give you a sense of that number, there are only 10 to the power 80 atoms in the universe. We're talking about a one with 120 zeros after it. The heavens are telling you, you are already living in a life from the dead kind of cosmos. And if you don't believe in a life from the dead kind of God, you are left with a far greater absurdity. How on earth do you explain the heavens? If there is an Easter kind of God, a life from the dead kind of God, your world makes sense. If there is not a life from the dead kind of God, then actually you've just introduced absurdity into your worldview. So the heavens are telling you there's a life from the dead God, but also history is telling you there's a life from the dead God. Here's what historians of all stripes will tell you, whether atheist, secular, Jewish, Christian, from all different backgrounds. Here are the facts of the first century. Okay, there was a guy called Jesus, and he was born around the year dot, and he had a whole bunch of followers. Even non-Christian writers were saying that he was a doer of marvelous deeds, miracles. But he got into trouble with the authorities, and around about AD 30, Pontius Pilate put him to death on a capital charge. He was crucified. He was dead. He was buried in a tomb. They all knew which tomb it was and where it was in Jerusalem. And yet 3 days later, that tomb is empty. And all his followers have experiences of meeting with the risen Jesus. Sometimes it's just one-to-one, but mostly it's in whole groups. And he eats with people, and he goes for long country walks, and he appears to 500 people at one time. And within days of this event, these disciples have their lives absolutely transformed to the point where they are proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus less than a mile away from the tomb that they proclaim is empty. The body is never found, and Christianity absolutely explodes from that point, to the point where it is the greatest sociological phenomenon the world has ever seen. There's been a big bang, if you like, of Christianity. And if you trace back the Big Bang to zero hour, where do you find? You find it's Easter Sunday. Something happens to turn these no-hopers, totally uneducated, with not an ounce of earthly power, turn them into men of flaming courage and women of flaming courage that turned the world upside down. How do you account for history? The heavens tell you there's a life from the dead gods. History tells you there's a life from the dead God. But then the third H, him. He will convince you that he is bigger than death. He will do that. How will he do it? Through this book. Did you notice how our reading ended? Verse 31, these things are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Because you might be sitting here and you might be thinking, I just wish I had what Thomas had. Wouldn't it be great if Jesus just appeared tonight? Wouldn't we then believe? Wouldn't that be great if St. Mary's Maidenhead managed to get not Glenn Scrivener tonight, but Jesus of Nazareth? That would be a step up, to put it mildly, right? And you would see him, and he would proclaim peace to you, and he would show you his hands and sides. That would be enough to make you believe for days, weeks maybe. But then tomorrow you'd go into work and you'd say they've really outdone themselves at St. Mary's Maidenhead, honestly. They had Jesus of Nazareth. It was incredible. Back from the dead, yes. And what are your friends going to tell you? Your friends are going to say, you idiots. How could you be so gullible? They do it with mirrors. What are you talking about? And you'd have to see Jesus again next week. And then you'd have to see him again. And then you'd have to see him again. And then you'd have to see him again. What's fascinating in all the Easter accounts, the way Jesus reveals himself to people is not so much going, ta-da. The way he's always revealing himself to people is opening up the Bible and showing them from the Bible how this had to be the case. Because he wants us to earth our beliefs, not in one-off apparitions that can be so difficult to believe 10 years down the line, 20 years down the line. He wants us to earth our belief in these words written in black and white for all time. Because I can know a God of peace who is bigger than death. I can know him at 2 a.m. when there's death in the family, when there's a health scare, when I lose my job. Here it is, in black and white for all time. I can have a Thomas experience. I can meet with Jesus. Jamie's talked to us about how knowing Jesus is different to knowing about Jesus. There comes a point where through this book you can meet with the risen Lord Jesus. There comes a point where you can say, I don't just know about him, I know him. I know his scar story. I know he has loved me to hell and back. I know my battle-scarred warrior loves me to death. And I've said to him, my Lord and my God. Is that something that you've been able to say to Jesus? Have you been able to say to Jesus, my Lord and my God? I want to challenge you tonight. Do good science. Do good investigation. Pick up the evidence. Read the history. Shoot up a prayer and say, Jesus, if you are there, please show yourself to me and prepare to meet Jesus in his scar story. Prepare to meet a God who would go to hell and back for you, because the stars rearranging, they probably won't change your mind. But the scars, that's another story. That story might just win your heart.